This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Oh, welcome to Community or Chaos, friends. And today we will be speaking with Councillor Steve Walker. And welcome to Community or Chaos, Steve.
Yeah, kia ora, Marvin. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the invite.
You can podcast this episode by going to oarfm.org.nz and then going to podcast and then going to Community or Chaos. Well, Steve, what motivated you to enter politics and stand for the city council?
I don't know how long I've got to answer that one, but fairly long and windy story for me. Never really been interested in politics other than standing on picket lines back in the, I guess, early 80s for me back in the UK, particularly two causes, fighting for the campaign for nuclear disarmament and the freeing of Nelson Mandela. Which goes back to my only arrest, my proud one arrest in life, standing up for human rights. So moved here with my wife as a professor at the university. Pretty much came here to retire in the early 2000s and do some gardening, which lasted about 2 weeks for me. Got intensely bored. Always been a keen cyclist and was cycling along the state highway between Port Chalmers and Dunedin, Port Chalmers, where I still live, and thought to myself, why can't we have some key sort of alternative infrastructure to get people who don't want to drive their cars every day to town? So started investigating how that happened. Didn't even know what a city council was, actually. Was told to go along to a public forum, didn't know what that was, and stood there shaking like a leaf with my British accent, asking the councillors then, 15 of them, if they could invest in some mode shift infrastructure. I got pretty short shrift, went home pretty angry. My wife said, do something about it. So then started investigating and learning how local politics in this country works. Eventually got sucked into the community board network. Didn't think I'd get elected. That was nearly 19 years ago. Stood for that, got elected in second place, and sort of the rest is history. I spent 12 years on the community board, 6 years as the chair. That's out in the West Harbour, it's now the West Harbour Community Board. And that was a way, I sort of worked out by then that it was a better methodology to access the people who could make decisions more widely. And of course, then community board led to people shoulder tapping me to stand for council. And here I am sitting here as a third term Dunedin City Council. The good news is we did get $55 million off of central government to build the network from Port Chalmers to Dunedin, which now is part of the whole round the harbour network, which arguably I would say is one of the best inner city walking cycling infrastructures on the planet.
Yes, I still use it on a warm morning. It's good exercise. It's a beautiful ride or walk, either one.
Yeah, it's amazing, eh? And weirdly, it doesn't affect drivers. And I think that's what we'll probably talk about this later, that narrative that having one thing affects somebody else. It works well for drivers as well as
well,
cyclists,
certainly
weirdly.
Much better for bicyclists to be totally separate. That can't always happen, but when it can, it's great.
That's right. Yeah, correct.
What are your priorities? I know bicycle paths are one of them. What other priorities do you have as a counselor?
Yeah, I mean, bicycle paths are a priority, but they sit for me in a wider context of just having, I guess, I mean, this goes back to like the Local Government Act and the purpose of it, but just having a supportive city actually with well-being at its heart. And I mean, cycleways sits in there as one of a massive basket full of things that can make that better. So do efficient, well-working roads and good parking facilities, actually. And that's, I think, as I've learned as a politician, the longer I get into this, it's one thing should never and doesn't necessarily play off against the other. So, listen, I'm a great believer of the social well-beings, and I'm a bit critical of this current government under its local government review to look to yet again, because it's been a bit of a ping pong ball has the well-beings, but again they're looking to eradicate them, which I think would be crazy, because we all function generally in our own lives, whether that be family, business, or politics, with hopefully with well-beings at heart. Because having, you know, deferring to the four well-beings benefits us all, whether that be social, cultural, environmental, go figure, or economic. Because despite my sort of left-wing politics, I do believe we do need a vibrant economy. I just probably argue about how that economy should function for the best needs of everyone, because I am a firm believer if everyone benefits, we all benefit, whether that be economically, socially, culturally, or environmentally. My vision for the city is for it to be vibrant, for people to want to live here, for people to want to wake up in the morning and go to work, for people to support each other. And we've just talked about the cycleways. One thing about being on a bike, and I did it this morning, I've just literally cycled in now, I'm a wee bit sweaty, is I probably said good morning or Ata Marie, Morena to about 50 people, and they all responded positively. That's a great start to my day. I don't think I generally get that in a car. I will stress, I'm not anti-car. It's amazing. I've been labelled as the anti-car councillor. I own and use a car, so I want the roading network and the parking facilities to work efficiently.
Well, my bicycle.
And excuse me, I'll say in advance, Martin, I tend to be a waffler, so feel free at any point. I won't take offence if you interject and cut me off. My wife does it all the time.
Well, my own bicycle's in the shop right now, waiting for a new tire.
Oh, right. Gosh. Well, I went to get a new tire 2 weeks ago and walked out the bike shop with a new bike, so be careful.
No, I'm afraid not. My income doesn't really cover that. Can you really have a well-being society with greater, when you leave the decisions that affect the public and affect the country to the market and have increasing inequality? Is that well-being?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, eh? I think you can have both. I just think we've opened the dam and we've let it run to a place which I think is hard to get back. And I'll think of two examples. I mean, America's at the end where the dam has long since burst. And I don't think, I mean, if you got a million people to brick by brick it back, I don't think it could work alone. My philosophy is always everything's possible. So, and I've been on the earth over 60 years now, and a lot of things have happened politically I never thought would. And some things have happened that have been tragic. But then you get examples of places, and I often do around the council table. I don't know if you're sad enough to watch any of the council meetings, but many people are. But I often use examples of countries in Scandinavia and other places, actually.
Yes, but they aren't totally free market. The government's willing to intervene. No. They're willing to raise taxes. They're willing make sure that workers in corporations have some kind of say. So that's totally different from America and totally different from New Zealand, frankly.
No, you're answering my question for me. So if we want to get to a place, Marvin, where we're not now, we have to look to a society like Scandinavia that accepts that a 50% basic tax rate is a good starting point. And then we have to look, you look people in the eyes and you tell them what they get for that. So if you want to see a doctor immediately and get your hip replaced within a week, you need to pay more. If you want your kids to go to a school of choice and have well-paid teachers in classrooms and not overrun with students, you need to pay more. If you want a roading system that's functional, you need to pay more. If you want more cycle lanes and better infrastructure, you need to pay more. And the list goes on. I think what we've become addicted to is a low tax regime, and that sits on both of the major parties, actually. People know I'm a Labour man, and I'll be the first to critique my own party, but they have both become obsessed with a low tax society. You can't have it both ways. You can't sit around promising you're going to do things and at the same time not ask us to pay for what we get. You can have a low tax society, and you can then look to pay more on your crime security around your house, because that's what's going to the American what happens in America has begun to happen here, and it'll start happening more and more and more if we keep the obsession with us not all paying what we should be paying into the system to make the system we want. Hey, how we get to an agreement on that is a whole different question. But what under the current modus operandi, nothing's going to change.
When I start thinking of economies that have done things differently in the European mode, I think of Finland. The reason I think of Finland is because not only do they have the best education system in the world, according to educationists, but they also have a free education all the way. But they also have some similarities in New Zealand. They have lots of trees. They have lots of logs. They have lots of lakes. But they don't have oil. They don't. They don't have heavy industry. And
Marvin, yet. I urge you to go back to the council meetings and look at the amount of times I've mentioned Finland and the amount of times their heads droop around the council table. It is the best example, and it didn't happen overnight. It's analogous to what. Are you aware of the Icelandic youth drinking problem model? If you're not, I'll give you a quick resume. They had like New Zealand, they had a massive youth drinking problem in Iceland. They decided to intergenerationally cure that problem. It took billions of dollars. It took the investment in parents. It took investment in schools. But they turned around an intractable problem and now have one of the lowest rates of teenage substance abuse on the planet. How did it happen? Intergenerational investment and political will. Finland's the same. It didn't turn this around overnight. It made a concerted decision decades ago for this to be the change. One thing you forgot to mention about Finland, it always tops the countries of surveying its own people of the best place to live in the world. So go figure, eh? Massive taxes at its base, but people have decided by paying more, they can create a better society.
And they have they've not only had the obstacles of having no more resources than New Zealand, but also of having to cope with a neighbor that's not necessarily friendly.
Very unfriendly, exactly. Finland is always an example I defer to, but there are other examples as well. But Finland is definitely top of my list.
What should Dunedin be doing to what kind of obligations do the government have to the people of New Zealand? And should they govern for the common good? And how would you define the common good?
Yeah, so, could I just break down that question? Because I am a local councillor. Is the question about national politics or local politics? Because
also fits either local or national.
Yeah, it does, but they are different roles. And I'll explain why. I mean, this is because a lot of people have shoulder tapped me and said, why don't you run for the Labour Party for this will explain my reasoning here. Why don't you run for Parliament? I said, listen, I could never run for Parliament unless I created my own party. or maybe ran with Victor and his alliance party. Who knows? But because I can't caucus, so this is why I like local government. Now, I'm just explaining the difference to your listeners here. If I was in a party in parliament, I'm sort of, unless it's a conscience vote, which is pretty rare, I have to do what I'm told. That's not within my nature. That's why I like local politics, because I get, even though I run and I'm endorsed by the Labour Party, I'm under no obligation, and despite what people have disseminated about me, I've scored out. There's a clause in the Labour Party signing up, which myself and the other candidate scored out, and because we wouldn't sign to be told what to do. So I'm a free agent. So in local politics, I can say and do what I want. If I was in Parliament, I'd be thrown out immediately. So that's why I just wanted to make that clear. There's a difference here. So in some ways, there's more power locally, and in some ways, there's more power nationally. So can you re-ask me the question in that context?
Well, one of the things I could ask you is, the government came to power, and a conservative government, and they made an indication that they wanted to return autonomy to local bodies and empower local bodies. Has that happened?
No, the absolute opposite has happened. I mean, it's an absolute sham. I mean, I'm also not a person who likes to sit there and just throw stones at parties, but this party got in on a number of promises, and it did a lot of things that it didn't have in its manifesto, the main one being the smoking regulations. But in terms of, we were all quite excited in some sense that this government promised localism at its heart. It has done the absolute opposite. It is,
they centralized more things than that.
Absolutely, and it's cleverly doing politically for itself. It's heaping a lot more work onto local government, but at the same time withdrawing that fiscal support. So you're seeing throughout across the Motu, the double digit rate rises have been there already, and we're looking at some authorities now because the local water one done well legislation now clicks into place. We're also obligated, even though the rates cap, 2% rates cap, isn't legislatively required until the long term plan, we've been told to prepare for it. So we're all sort of got this sort of this fiscal sword of Damocles dangling over us. So you've got some local authorities that have got over 20% rate rises. We've got an indication of 10.7. We're under great pressure to reduce that. I'm hoping we will, but we're asked, sadly, that envelope of things we're required to do, particularly the expensive things, local water done well, which I think to credit of this current government, I think it's a good thing we're legislated to invest in water. Previously we weren't; it was a choice, and we're also legislated in essence to build roading. So those are the two most expensive things. So our local rates are made up over 80% of water and your roading system. So we're asked to do way more of that work, but with way less money. The only way we can make that money, of course, is raise rates. Not so bad if you're in Auckland or maybe a Christchurch, but for a city like Dunedin, we're a bit screwed. For smaller councils, I probably can't swear in this show, but make it up in your head. They are completely beat. So, so there's going to have to be a change of direction from government and or mass amalgamation of those smaller councils, and probably a creation of a bunch of unitary councils, I'd imagine, which I'm relatively agnostic on. But, I live in the real world. I'm also very, I think I'm very good around the numbers and the balance sheet side of what councils do. So I'm a realist as well, but and anyone who runs the household budget will know if you're asked to do a lot more and your wage is dropping, it becomes difficult. You've got to cut, or you've got to raise money from elsewhere. And our elsewhere is the ratepayer, and I don't think it's sustainable. When I moved here in 2001, I think my rates were in the hundreds. They're now getting close to 3,500. So, and
rates don't have anything to do with your income. They're not connected.
Yeah, that's right. Correct.
You could be a millionaire, and you'd be paying the same similar rates to somebody who was on the just above the benefit.
Oh, of course, yeah. Most billionaires have multiple properties, so they just pass on that rate rise anyway. So probably ultimately don't end up paying any rates if you if it, when it when it when it all comes out in the wash. No, it's ridiculous. I mean the fact that I'm also I'll be careful because I am a fan of universality in some senses, like the pension, for example. I think that's fine. And it is interesting to see that both parties are talking about attacking the universality of that. But yeah, I mean, you're right. It's incredible that somebody on less than minimum wage who just has lucky enough to live in a house has to pay proportionately way, way, way more than those people who are earning hundreds of thousands or of course into the millions.
Should local bodies be urging the government and investigating themselves in ways of funding infrastructure and other local body needs beyond rates?
Yeah, I mean and to be fair, it's not just rates that pay for it. There are other ways already that do happen. And development contributions is one thing. That's when, for example, if a developer builds a 200 house lot, they pay through what's called development contributions for that infrastructural in the starting point. So there are other ways already. But hey, I mean, ever since I've been in local body, the local councils are always looking other ways to raise funds, and the big one at the moment is the appeal to central government, which still doesn't have a no yet, is to get that GST back. The GST that's paid locally back comes back to us. That would be quite a good boost. But hey, listen, I think it's a broken model. It's a model that's worked in the past, but I think the model needs to change because it's simply not sustainable. As I said earlier, if you're putting a 10% annualized increase on, say, let's say 4,000, work that out for 4 years, 5 years down the line. Just you're going to get a situation where people literally can't pay rates, and nobody wants that. Doesn't benefit anyone. So probably benefits those who want a revolution, and you know, arguably some might not be the worst thing. But you know, I'm not advocating for a revolution. But you always, as governors, are looking at ways to make sure you're doing best for your community. So it's not sustainable. And imagine, Marvin, one of the ways is, and I am fairly agnostic on this, and I think there might be some credit in looking to amalgamate some of those smaller councils. Because you imagine being on the West Coast, where you've got a massive geographical area, humongous infrastructure requirements, and a ratepayer base is in the thousands. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not doable, simply. So you need to look at amalgamation of councils, and I think Dunedin will be part of that, but will probably be one of the controlling bodies within some sort of an amalgamated system. So that's one of the ways. But in answer to your question, we are always, so we regularly meet with ministers of all parties, of Greens, of the Opportunist Party, of the Reds and the Blues, and we are always pleading our case, whether that's locally or through Local Government New Zealand, which is the amalgamated body of all 67 authorities. So don't. And I mean, I'm none of us, to be fair, are silent on that. So it's a given that something needs to change.
Inland Revenue actually is fairly efficient at collecting taxes. And why can't Inland Revenue collect taxes for local bodies, and the local bodies make the decision on how much taxes they need or want so that they can be held accountable for the tax rate for the local area? But why shouldn't it come out of a national inland revenue?
I don't really understand the question, because I don't think the way we collect rates at the moment is inefficient, actually. I think it's
no,
very
I'm saying
efficient.
It income taxes fairer than rates.
Yeah, but I mean, if we change the parameters by which rates are collected, listen, I always use as an example, there's always a line drawn somewhere. There's always, whatever system you have, there'll be some somebody on one side of the line that goes, phew, that's a great system. But sadly, there's always people on the other side of the line that won't. And I mean, I've never even thought about this before. I've not had that question put to me. But I mean, I'll think on my feet here. But I'd imagine my first response would be, wealthy people are really efficient at not paying taxes. So straight away, I'd be nervous that if we're getting into a system whereby those clever people are not clever, just those people who can afford clever accountants can then start avoidance.
Well, they can also afford to give lots of money to political parties to make sure aren't changes.
We're definitely going to agree on that one. But that's going to take a systemic change and a bit of bravery, please, from one of our national parties. It ain't going to come from the blue. So I would urge my own Labour Party to be much braver in having a much fairer tax system at the top end. And listen here, I'm never, and I'm sure you're not, I'm never advocating that rich people shouldn't be rich, but if somebody's earning 100 million a year, I'm hardly going to be crying into my soup if they can only earn 95 million a year. That's, I don't think that creates a problem. And often we'll hear the right saying, well, if we tax the rich, they'll move somewhere else. My challenge would be, well, cheerio, bye-bye, I'll help you pack your bags. Because, again, going back to Scandinavia, rich people are heavily taxed there. And guess what? They choose to live in Scandinavia because the things they get there, so don't forget this, the things you invest that income in make them want to live there.
Also, you're living in a society that's reasonably secure.
You're living in a society that's, well, I don't, yeah, exactly, secure, but also add the word fair. I think it's intrinsically at heart, and I've had this argument with many people at many dinner party tables, people across the world, and I've traveled to 107 countries, are intrinsically good everywhere. So we all basically want the same things. We want safety, security, we want a home, we want a job, we want friends, we want togetherness, and we want company, we want an environment in which we want to be. And that seems to get lost. So seriously, my challenge to those rich people at the top, if you want to leave New Zealand, adios, guys, adios, because I know one thing, you ain't going to be leaving. You're going to be paying a wee bit more, and guess what? You're all going to be still super, super rich.
When it comes to resilience, how is South Dunedin doing? It seems to me that in regard to flooding, there's a long-term issue of climate change and the immediate short-term considerations of poor storm water and flood control that probably needed to be resolved yesterday instead of in the long term.
Listen, this is South Dunedin is really common. And it's not just South Dunedin. It's lots of areas in Aotearoa. It's lots of areas across the Motu. It's lots of areas across the world, including those areas that I've researched in Wales and the UK, which have had to move out. And we're talking about moving a community out of an area of Christchurch. Listen, for some weird reason, post-COVID, that thing called climate change seems to have disappeared from the political radar, which for somebody like myself is astounding. We are living now in a context where, whether we like it or not, the oceans are going to win. Weather is changing. I think we're beyond the debate now of what caused it. We don't need to debate that. The reality is sea levels are going to continue to rise around the world, and they're going to continue to rise here. What can we do? We can do nothing. And that's often the place of the extreme right, is it's all a hoax. Let's do nothing. Let's put our heads in the sand and hope, because it ain't going to affect us anyway, because we're rich enough and we can move to wherever we want to move to. In terms of South Dunedin, I think we as a council, it's one of the things we can be most proud of is the South Dunedin Futures work. It is an attempt politically, at huge expense, to go and investigate what's happening, to actually get the real data collected over years, aggregate it, model it, and try to understand what's going to happen. By understanding that, which we now do, we can come up with options. We came up with eight options, which is do nothing, right through to to completely removing everything out of South Dunedin and abandoning it back to the sea. I think rightly, because of the evidence and the timescales required, we've landed on option, I think it's 3 and 4, which is a bit of both, which is ceding some of that dune network back to the ocean and creating natural landscapes. Great for our Tonga species actually, and great for the environment. But at the same time, recognizing that some places will probably some people will have to move, but could be relocated in the similar areas, just on higher ground. But letting water be part of everyday living. So it's not panic stations. It's understanding what the future looks like in the shorter term. I think, and I do have views on what's happened locally in terms of our investment. We're probably, of all 67 councils, we're one of the few councils in New Zealand that decided, and this goes back to Dave Cole's tenure, so we're talking 12 years ago, so 4 cycles ago, to actually start investing in upgrading our water infrastructure when nobody else was forced to do it or had to do it. It was continued under the Hawkins council, and it was continued under Raddick's council as well. So we're sort of ahead of the game. We shouldn't be smug though, but because we started investing before everybody else, because we're still looking at billions of dollars of investment. Politically at the moment, because, and listen, I have immense sympathy for people who have sewage coming up through the ground. But the worst thing you can do there is spend tens of millions reacting to a situation that might ultimately not be the solution. So what we've decided to do 12 years ago, and certainly under Dave Ward, who's the manager now of Waters, is to look holistically at the whole city and develop solutions holistically based on the whole network. The one thing you don't want to do is continue running along with plasters, patching bits up without holistically fixing the whole network. Remembering that South Dunedin is not only reclaimed land, it's where the water flows to off the hills. So we're investing now, I think, under political pressure to install something that ultimately won't be the solution. Still supported it because I think we need to be seen to be doing something, but solving the problems won't be solved with pipes. The problem will be solved with understanding the problem of where we should and shouldn't live, and making sure we invest heavily in the infrastructural inputs, the actual pipes and pumps in the ground, where ultimately we're all going to continue living. So that's a long-winded way of saying I think we're ahead of the game, and it's no surprise to me that councils from across New Zealand and from across the world are flying in to speak to our staff to understand how we did this work and how they can copy and replicate it to look at their communities to make sure they build in resilience for the centuries to come. There's no silver bullet here, but there is an opportunity to look at the whole system and understand it, and to be honestly, to be brave with our community, particularly those people who may have to move from where they've always lived. And I know from the UK, it's not an easy thing to convince people to move from where they've lived for generations, but we've got to be honest and upfront with them about why they have to do that. And if you do look at what happened in Wales, it wasn't easy convincing a community to move their whole town away from where they've always lived. And we're going to see more and more of this. This will just be a regular thing that happens across the world.
Well, this would be.
I don't think I took a breath there, did I?
No, this would be one of the reasons I would argue that a party that, like most of the parties in New Zealand, particularly the centre parties, want to avoid change, and that's probably the one thing we can't avoid is change.
I agree. I mean, I always say again at my dinner parties, listen, guys, there's only two certainties in life. It's not death and taxes, it's death and change. And listen, let's not, I will give a bit of credit here to the Labour Party because it was known before when we were doing the South Dunedin's Future Networks work, we had an application into the former government, the Labour government, and it was the first of its kind. Literally, I think across the world, that was a huge amount of money we were asking for to have the ability, it was in the hundreds of millions, to buy up properties in South Dunedin that were vulnerable. And the idea behind that was to buy those properties, rent them back to the people who were living there. So you're not throwing the people out, but we now own the properties. But what we then controlled, what we owned was the control. So in the future, when we had a mass flood event, or let's wind on 30 years when flooding is becoming regular in those properties, we own those properties. So we wouldn't be in the situation of having to buy the properties up. It was actually trying to get invest and be ahead of the game. It was actually a great example of investing in inevitable change. Because of the change of government, that application when the new government came in was thrown away. And I have it on good authority that that application under the previous government had a thumbs up. So this new government came in and threw that away. That is actually being really proactive. It's future-proofing, and it is actually understanding that change is coming. So let's give a wee bit of credit there. It never happened, but those sort of things will have to happen in the future. But you're not right, Marvin. If we're not able to change in any facet of our life, we're doomed. And that goes, I mean, I've been married for 23 years. I have my wife and I, she's American. So not that all Americans are good, but I'm a Brit. I used to, if there's a problem, I stick my head in the sand, but Americans seem to talk things through. And I've got, a really well-functioning relationship because I talk through things and I accept, you know, we have differences and you have to change sometimes. But you're right. If you're not prepared to change, particularly in the year 2026, you're going to very quickly wither on the vine, particularly in the world of AI. Hey, I mean, we've got opportunities with AI. I think there's some great problems with AI. But in terms of things like looking to model resilience to climate change, and actually in the sphere my wife works in, the medical profession, the speed at which they can aggregate research numbers now is astounding. So there's opportunities, but you're right. Yeah, if we don't change, we die.
What responsibilities do local bodies have to their residents?
Well, we have immense responsibility. Thankfully, through not ourselves, through the well-known 2002 Local Government Act, actually. So that's the act under which we operate, which has obviously a purpose, key functions, and requires us to consult on decision making through things like 9-year plan, 10-year plan. Sorry, I say 9-year because we did a 9-year plan because of COVID. Under 10-year plans, and works along other local legislative acts, particularly around things like Manafena, Tonga Te Whenua, and the treaty. So yeah, I mean we have an obligation currently to empower empower us to meet current and future community needs, and to promote, I guess, democratic decision making, which I think we do have here. Actually, it can be frustrating and slow compared to the UK, but I think the price of that slowness is good democratic decision making. Not that everyone would agree with it, and of course those community well-beings. My worry is that the part of the Local Government Act, the well-being part, is again under attack, which I think is really sad. So yeah, we're bound, thankfully, by the LGA, which if we weren't, would be a bit of a nightmare. I mean, sometimes do believe some of my fellow elected members forget that, actually, but we yeah.
At the present time, there are certain obligations that the government, many people would think, should be looking after. For instance, homelessness. And ability to put food on the table. And the government's not doing this, and they haven't done it for, well, it isn't just this government. Labor wasn't doing it either.
Yep.
So where does that leave local governments responsible? What responsibilities do we have? Should we when we see homeless people, should we ask the police to move them on or fine them or put them in jail?
No, please not. No, and then this goes back to my first answer. I think if we wind back to the beginning of this interview, where it's a perfect example, Marvin, of central government deferring its responsibility to local government. And homelessness is probably a better example than the one I gave you. So, and straight off, I know this government would argue strongly. They would probably say they are investing in homelessness, which is quite laughable when we look around the streets. And when they rip a
Well, they're investing
apart,
in the well-being of real estate owners.
Yeah, that's right.
And large-scale landowners.
They are absolutely de-investing in Kangiora. And I mean, where I live in Port Chalmers is a good example of that. We had, and again, I'll defend the previous government, actually, because you critique them, and that's your right. But under the previous government, the Kangiora housing project in Port Chalmers was absolutely going to happen. They demolished reasonable houses, not perfect, they were reasonable, to build more houses on a bit of land which now is derelict and might remain that way until some private rich landlord comes along and builds their house. But this is across the motor, they reviewed Kangaroo housing and decided places like Port Chalmers and many hundreds of other places weren't worth building these houses. The example is we're the second largest holder of community housing in New Zealand as a local authority. Not bad, eh, for a wee place like Dunedin. So Wellington has more than us. We have the second largest amount of community housing, and all the advantages, and we own it. So some local authorities have sold their housing off to what they call CHIPS. I don't know what the acronym is, but we haven't. So we have the ability here, thankfully, still to be able to control the amount of rent that we charge our most vulnerable. And I'm really proud of that. And I'm constantly fighting around the council table to make sure that those rents remain as low as possible. And we've got councillors around the council table saying that those rents should go up substantially to, in essence, pay market value related to other social housing throughout New Zealand. Ridiculous in my mind. So we still own that. We had an investment to build, I think it was $3 million we put aside in the long-term plan last time to keep building. When Jules became mayor, that was a motion came to council to tear that down. So we don't have that anymore. So I'm hoping after this by-election, if we get the right candidate across the line, that we can put a motion back to council to restart our community housing build again. But going back to your original question, great example of central government asking us to do more with less. So how much do we get from central government for our community housing build? Diddly squat, big fat zero. We get nothing from central government. So a great example of deferring to local government that has an effect on rates going up. Government gets away with murder, literally, while we have to take on the obligation of building our own community housing. I don't think there's any other local authority apart from us that's doing that. So again, let's be a wee bit proud of what we're doing here, but let's not lose sight of the fact that we must keep critiquing government. I'm with you, whatever colour. So I'll be the first to be on Labour's case if they win, Labour and Greens, if they win the next election. I was at the Housing Hui run by Francisco and Tamitha Paul and Scott Willis at the weekend. It was held at Age Concern, just I'm pointing here because it was just down the road, where there was an implicit promise there from Tamitha Paul, who holds a housing portfolio for the Greens, that they would invest in social housing. So I'll be the first to be on the phone to both Labour and the Greens to make sure they fulfil that promise. And I think we should work in tandem with central government over addressing homelessness and the lack of housing. It's a multifaceted approach to it that takes both. It'll take our will, and it'll take central government's will to do something about it. But if we don't do it, if we don't do anything about it, we're going to go the American way. And I don't know about you. The last time I was in, last time I went to the beautiful city of San Francisco, I was literally walking over people on the streets. This is the city on the planet with the highest level of education in the world, with one of the worst homelessness problems in the world. I don't know how that square ever gets circled.
Well, that was political choice. I mean, if you look at economics of a country, it's because the people that influence government have lots of money that they want to keep, and they can use that money to control politics.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, great wealth leads to great inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. No argument from me.
But it appears to me that neither of the major political parties are challenging this in New Zealand. You've got the leader of the Labour Party hasn't really walked back from his previous position opposed to the major tax reform. And you've seen what National's doing.
I really want to ask you personally,
since we're talking about how can you actually support a centre-right Labour government?
I thought we might get to this question, Marvin, but it is a good question. So, listen, I'm not going to make excuses for myself here, but I never wanted to join a party, but I did, and I joined Labour, and I did it for good reason, because I joined under, I was encouraged by Marion Hobbs, who is a politician I really admire and respect, and particularly the historical fact she was once a member of the Communist Party, which I can imagine Marion being and a very effective member of. Listen, I remain a member of the Labour Party. I'm a proud member of the Labour Party because, and you're right, they're not left enough for me. But if people like me decide to then jump ship, I think it's a lost cause. I remain literally a member of the Labour Party because I want to be a member that impels Labour to get back to its roots. And I mentioned Victor Billard earlier for good reason, because I mean he's probably further down the line than me in terms of being a disillusioned ex-Labour man.
Well, I used to be a Labour member.
Yeah, exactly. So I remain because I'm a great believer in, and this is goes back to the very original question you asked, why did I get into politics? I got into politics because people told me it would be a better forum in which I could make change, so I could get involved with creating, writing, and passing policy. And that sort of is a roundabout way of answering this question, that if I leave and other lefties leave, then we're doomed to more centrist movings of that party. And don't get and listen, within the party there are some don't think for one moment there isn't robust debate about the direction in which it will go. Although, like many Labour people, I got so disillusioned at the last election when I wanted the party to shift really left, and it went really centre right. It chickened out. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. It chickened out, trying to grab a vote it really shouldn't want to have to grab, actually. And I'm a great believer in principle. I've always said to people when I leave politics and write my memoirs, it'll probably never happen, I'll be too busy gardening. But when I write my memoirs, one thing I'll be able to leave saying is I've never corrupted my principles. So I was a bit disappointed that Labour, for me, corrupted their principles. So I remain in the party to encourage them, to the best of my ability, to get back to a place that encouraged me to join them in the first place. And you can look back in this interview in a few years, because if they don't do that, I probably will leave, actually. And I might take a wee journey on the road with Victor and his team, because at the moment, I look through the Alliance policies and think maybe it is a bit more, that's a bit more me, actually. So I'm giving Labour a chance, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be forever, because if it certainly moves more centrist, it's not going to be acceptable. And I don't think it'll be acceptable to a lot of the core key people who are the infrastructure of the party, and that would be really sad. But yeah, listen, I you know, the it ain't without robust debate, and I don't know if you've been in a party before, but it's not easy being in the party mechanism. But I think I've given you a reasonable answer, because they're on a warning for me. Maybe they don't give a shit about what I think, but listen, that's where I sit. And to be honest, I'm always naturally a green anyway. Before I was shoulder tapped by Labour, I was shoulder tapped by the Greens to run the ticket with them because a lot of my policies are very much on the green part of the Labour of the Labour Party, which ain't green enough either. So I don't even think the Greens are green enough. But there we go.
So one of the things I think that this country, to some extent, has changed. I remember in the 70s. In Wanganui, some families didn't bother with cars, but most families didn't have two or three. In my own neighborhood, which is a working class neighborhood, mostly no off street parking. Just about every house has two or three cars. And this says something about both our transport system, but also the wanting to have more and more. And we don't live in a world that will necessarily give us more and more material. It seems to me that we need to be driven both by fairness and by the environment to have a society that's more equal and also a society that's more careful about how we use things and to prepare to live well with less. And I remember, well, I don't remember this, to be honest, but I know that the first Labour government, when they retired in the 40s, they retired to state houses. They didn't retire to two or three houses. They didn't retire to expensive houses.
Yeah.
And now I look at the lifestyle of politicians and the experience. And most, they often don't have the experience of how to survive with little or nothing.
Yeah. Yep.
And you need some kind of real life experience to feel what happens to people when you can't afford to buy a house, when you can't afford to pay rent, when you can't put food on the table, where you have insecure employment.
Yep. Absolutely. Your commentary is, it's not so much a question, but it's a commentary which I don't disagree with. And I mean, I'm somebody who grew up with in the UK under Thatcher, so it sort of formed my political leanings quite early on. So I went to uni in 83. So it was just at sort of the height of Thatcherism. Thatcher came in 79. And of course, Britain probably had arguably the best what we call council housing set up in the world. I mean, it obviously stemmed from a post-war scenario. We had to build lots of houses quickly, but they were built for people who didn't have much. And that was sort of a given that everyone in the UK would have a council house. And of course Thatcher came in and tore that up and said that you could now sell council houses on the open market. Hey, and guess what happened? Hey, lots of rich people came in with hundreds of millions of dollars and bought up tens of thousands of council houses. It was sold as letting those people with not much, gave them the ability to buy a house. It may have happened around the edges, but largely it very quickly became controlled by the landlord class, and the story remains a tragedy of letting the market take over, because of course the streets of Britain now are just awash with.
We only have a few more minutes. We probably should talk about the fuel crisis.
Yeah, let's go. We'll have to do this again, Marvin.
About the fuel crisis, how will Zealand cope, and how will Dunedin cope? And are we preparing for a fuel crisis?
In terms of locally, there's not much we can do other than round the edges. Of course, we don't run the buses, ORC do. And I mean, I've been a great advocate, forget the fuel crisis, I've always been a great advocate of having buses. Buses should be free for everyone. It's always politically charged when I say this, but we don't actually have clogged roads in Dunedin. People who've lived here forever or a long time think we do. And thankfully, when they go traveling, they realize how good it is here. Listen, nationally, I don't think we're doing enough. I don't know if the onus should be on us locally, other than making sure we make our public transport.
Do you have confidence in the government's plans to deal with the fuel crisis? I mean, do you have confidence they have good plans and that they're
I don't think we do have good plans. I mean, we moved to the just-in-time model, and listen, for good reason, probably many, many moons ago, because it's probably not the wisest thing in the world to have a year's fuel sitting there ad infinitum for 80 years. But we live in a just-in-time economy, and we're very dependent on two countries. Thankfully, they're probably fairly.
Do you think with the economics minister that this crisis will soon be over, and we don't really have to worry about with how to deal with it when it gets much worse?
Listen, I reckon we could spend a whole hour on this. The crisis could be overnight if Donald Trump decided to pull back on his aggression in the Strait of Hormuz. It's an incredible situation we're in here. What our government should be doing is widely condemning Donald Trump and widely condemning Netanyahu for their warmongering, their murder, their destruction of innocent people in the Middle East.
Well, I agree with what they should be doing, but we should also be preparing. Preparing for running out of fuel. We should be considering rationing free public transport.
That's what I said. Free transit, public transport should be at the forefront. The rationing, supposedly, according to their system, they got the 1, 2, 3, 4. We're still on level one. At level two, supposedly, rationing comes into place. Listen, this is all going to be like COVID. We're going to be when the shit hits the fan, we're going to be running around initiating policies that may or may not be right. But at the end of the day, what we need to be doing ultimately, Marvin, is weaning ourselves off of this thing called oil. We have a woeful uptake of electric cars here. We have a woeful uptake of solar, blah, 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 blah.
Okay, Steve, for coming on.
Yeah.
And
I knew that an hour would fly past very quickly, but I think we need to do this again and maybe cut down the number of subjects.
Okay, fair enough.
Nice talking to you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.